the underlying physics that determines how galaxies form. So I was particularly interested to attend this conference because I'm hoping to be brought up to date on what is known and considered about the halos, dark matter halos of dwarf galaxies. And I'd love to have some feedback on my impression of the situation. So to begin, here from Simon White, is a numerical n-body simulation, pure dark matter. You see the dark matter organized in halos. You see that the most massive halos, which are a suitable home for the most luminous galaxies, tend to be near the centers of concentrations of intermediate mass halos. That is a good thing. The most luminous galaxies like prefer dense regions. You also see that outside the intermediate mass concentrations, trailing off into the wilderness, into the voids, are low mass halos. This, I shall argue, is a questionable thing. So let us look at the situation in our immediate neighborhood, and I begin with the most luminous galaxies nearby. This is from Karachensev et al., 2004, catalog of nearby galaxies, supposed to be complete to a radius of 8 megaparsecs with the current distance scale. He put a few outliers in for reasons that escape me. The sphere of 8 megaparsecs radius is put in a cube. We see two projections of the cube. The orientation is relative to the de Vaucouleurs local supercluster. You see the local sheet, the tendency of galaxies to lie on a plane, but curiously is aligned with the large-scale distribution of clusters up to maybe 50 megaparsecs, but that's a separate problem. Shown are the 7 most luminous galaxies in this sample. It happens they're all spirals. There's at least one decent-sized elliptical, Centaurus, in this region, but it happens not to make the cut. It is fascinating and familiar to you all that these 7 have a small range in luminosity, just a factor of 2. Startling that galaxies at the bright end are made to a pretty standard mold, which is just another way of saying we have an exponential luminosity function cutoff. Curious to me, I don't know what to make of it, is that the number 4 in luminosity and the number of 6 are touching into, in islands or peninsulas sticking out into the local Ertelli void. Here's M101 to the right and 6946 to the left. So far as I can tell, they're ordinary spirals. A little curious because you might wonder what torqued up their spins. One usually says it's the merging of the pieces out of which the massive halo is made and the angular momentum going then to the baryons and spinning up as the baryons contract. But in these little islands, there isn't a lot of extra mass to take up the torque. So that what ends up in the dark matter halo does have angular momentum. I don't know whether that's a serious problem. I don't even know whether these two sit on the Tully-Fisher relation. Maybe they're a little off, and maybe that would be interesting to discover. I am more interested in the moment in the distribution of low luminosity galaxies. Here is an example of the relative distributions in space of the galaxies in this local Karachensev sample. What I've done is first truncate the sample to 7 megaparsecs, just because the edges, one might imagine, are a little ratty. Then next, oh, here it is, put a point on the 7 megaparsec sphere at a convenient spot, then lay down a nested set of spheres with radii so adjusted that the 20 slices created have equal volume. If this doesn't look like equal volume, remember that it's a figure of rotation. Now count in each the number of galaxies, either the bright sample or the faint sample. Divide by the total number of galaxies in that sample. Divide by the fraction of volume, which is to say multiply by 7 by 20. The result is the mean number density in that slice relative to the mean number density in the sphere. Here are the results. One it's red and I guess black or a sort of purple, but you see two curves and you have a lot of trouble seeing any difference between the two. The bright galaxies, brighter than minus 17, and the faint galaxies have the same distribution. You're not surprised. Nobody is over here in the void. Most everybody is here in the local sheet, and there is a sprinkling of galaxies below the local sheet with similar number densities in the giants and the dwarfs. That is a curious thing to me. Now I go on to look at extreme dwarfs of a particular kind. I think that for this game, the dwarfs that are more interesting are those that are gas rich. That's because we have first the empirical result that a gas-rich dwarf is seldom seen next to a big galaxy. Not surprising, these guys have H1 disks that are supported by rotation. The disks, you would imagine, are fragile, susceptible to being disrupted in a tidal field. The disruption, you would imagine, causes a lot of the gas to turn into stars and makes a slightly more luminous optical galaxy without so much H1 hanging around. These, therefore, you can imagine have lived tranquil lives. They're the sorts of galaxies that would have avoided, therefore, the harassment and the stripping of the outer parts by tides suffered by low-mass halos that are in high-mass halos. Furthermore, they're the sorts of guys you could imagine would be happy living in a local void. Once there, they are minimally at danger of being harassed. Interesting to notice some numbers. H1 mass 5×10⁸, H1 mass to blue band luminosity 20, which is to say with a standard mass to light ratio, the baryons that are seen are dominated by the H1. Pretty high ratio here, and H1 mass 3×10⁸, pretty close to the total seen baryon mass. Here, again the same, 2×10⁸ total baryon mass. Here, H1 over L only unity. You should therefore add a little bit to this 1×10⁷, maybe give it 3×10⁷ solar masses in baryons. So the range in baryon mass, 3×10⁷ to 3×10⁸. Circular velocities, 15. I got that from 10 times the square root of 2. Deep calculation. 15, 40, 40, 50. A considerable range. That sigma lower bound, 10 kilometers per second, circular velocity maybe 15, is really fascinating, particularly in light of what we heard yesterday about the many dwarfs near the Milky Way that have similar line of sight velocity dispersions. It is, to me, tempting to think there's a good reason for it, the well-advertised one, that if the velocity dispersion or circular velocity is much less than that, then heating by ionizing radiation is going to allow the plasma to stream away rather than recombine. You might imagine that dwarfs that have circular velocities less than 10 kilometers per second aren't observed because they were quite unable to hold on to their baryons. A standard story, and it certainly seems reasonable on the face of it. I don't know whether it is known to be reasonable to those who actually do studies of this sort of thing. So we notice where these guys are. Maybe I should have stressed, you can see the, in some cases, only real astronomers can see the stars. I hope everyone here who is Canadian knows what DDO means. You do? Oh, good. And who made that catalog? Sydney Vandenberg, back when the DDO was not a high-priced housing development. In other cases, the stellar component is very easy to see. This even has an NGC number, but that's because it's a very compact stellar component. Please.
Covered by blind H1 surveys?
No. On the other hand, the part that has been covered has given us an interesting rule, you recall. No one, to my knowledge, has found an H1 cloud outside, let's say, 100 kiloparsecs from an optical object. The void has been surveyed by eyeballs, not only Sidney's, but also Karen Chensev's. They, both of them refused to assure me that they found all of the optical objects, but they've gone a long way down, of course. It is worth emphasizing that these are more luminous than these exceedingly faint dwarfs that are seen around the Milky Way and M31. I might well imagine that, these guys, if they lived near the Milky Way, would have lost a lot of H1 and might have been a lot less luminous. Who knows? Please.
Like there's a departure from spherical symmetry in at least some of them?
These are disks seen tilted. They're supported by rotation. In all cases, except maybe this one, which has sort of a complicated jumbled motion. Again, not surprising you're supported by a rotation, because if you're going in a chaotic way, these clouds are apt to bump into each other hard enough to ionize themselves and cause collapse of stars. So at least in these three cases, I think in all the four cases on the left, the H1 is supported by rotation. And now you look at where they are. And you're not surprised there are none in the local void. This local void has an object in it that some authors say is in the void. Karen Chensev says is on the far side in projection. The dwarfs aren't. Is that a worry? Will we find H1 galaxies like this in the void, perhaps without any stars, since we have no examples of an H1 object without stars? That seems doubtful, but we'll see. And the Arecibo alfalfa survey is looking for these guys, and we will see if they find any. That certainly will be followed with interest. A cautionary remark. Let's see, I've already made the first remark. And it is interesting, as has been pointed out by people, that you may not be surprised that you can't find a pure H1 galaxy, but even these guys are dissipating energy through rotational support and differential rotation. And maybe it's a rule that if you are high enough surface density to make a visible disk, then you're going to have to form some stars to have a little feedback to keep the thing supported. Second cautionary remark, there is gas in plasma in voids detected through the Lyman alpha resonance line at surface densities way below what's observable in 21 centimeter emission, down surface densities 10 to the 15 and thereabouts. It is only known, as far as I've been able to discover, that this void plasma has low heavy element abundance. It is not known, as far as I can tell, whether or not it is trapped in a dark matter halo or whether it's simply free floating. I would love to know whether, if you put a bare dark matter halo into this diffuse plasma cloud, it would be able to gather enough of the plasma to form a galaxy through accretion. It's a little bit hard unless the halo mass is high, because the plasma is up around 10 to the fourth degrees and has high enough pressure to resist falling into a potential well that has a circular velocity of only 10 or 20 kilometers per second. So I come to my final slide, which I managed to phrase, I think, in one sentence. So as I think I understand the situation, a gaseous dwarf requires isolation so as to avoid disruption. That's a simple empirical fact, and certainly it seems to make entire physical sense. They require a high enough surface density to avoid ionization by the ionizing extragalactic radiation, surface density around 10 to the, sorry?
How do you define dwarf?
Oh, the little guys. I don't have a definition. Way below L star. Let's say three orders.
Being optical.
in optical.
Okay.
These are, of course, also very low mass H1 halos. We're talking 3/10 to the 7th, 3/10 to the 8th. They require surface density greater than 10 to the 18, as I say, to avoid ionization. They also require that to be seen by radio telescopes. So there's both a selection effect in detection and in formation. They also require circular velocity. Well, I put 20. Maybe I should have put 15 kilometers per second. Line of sight velocity dispersion 20. I think we shouldn't be surprised, although I have not done serious analysis of this, that that is a reasonable criterion for being able to hold on to their H1. So we have the theoretical issues that I wish to bring to your attention. What is the predicted number density of such halos at redshift 20? Maybe I would revise that and say at redshift 10 even. There are several reasons for emphasizing that. First, at redshift about 10, one would imagine that a void that now has a density maybe 10% of the mean was starting to have a density appreciably departing from the mean, wouldn't you say? That is when galaxy formation is stopping, or halo formation would tend to stop in that region. So that is when you would like to know how many dwarf low-mass halos there are per unit volume. And at that point, you maybe don't care whether they're in proto-voids or proto-occupied regions, because the density contrast is modest. It's also late enough that one would imagine that these low-mass halos have already formed, by and large. It's also early enough that you would imagine the baryons are still largely neutral and therefore capable of falling into the whole void, into the halo, along with the dark matter. Knowing the number density back then, which I would assume you guys could tell me if you wanted to look, I could divide by 10 to take account of a nominal difference of the density in a void relative to the mean density, and get the predicted number of these dwarf, potentially H1-rich galaxies in a void, predicted number density. Is that a number we could write down on the blackboard? Oh. That would be interesting. We need to know also the number, the loss of numbers of voids by merging, the void dwarfs by merging. I'm assuming that's small, because by the time you get to redshift 10, as we note, the density is getting substantially below the mean, and the merger rate is starting to drop off. Well, I mean, once you're in a low density region, you no longer are gravitationally unstable.
But is that redshift 10?
Well, I mean, if the density in the void now is 10%, uh-huh. And if I don't do a calculation, then I'd say it's about a factor of 10 expansion. Okay. Density contrast going linearly with expansion parameter.
Yeah. Maybe it's not quite that old, because it's a little bit like spherical collapse in reverse. It's not that they grow, it goes nonlinear, so.
Well, right, well, once it's gone nonlinear, then Bob's your uncle, you've got the halo. But then I suppose
so, you know, I mean the voids have gone nonlinear, they're 10%.
Oh, yeah, I should do a calculation. I should at least do spherical symmetry model. And it must be that if there are two dwarf halos at redshift 10 like this, then they may end up now like this. No problem. But do I expect that somebody over here is going to drift over? I'm assuming not. Although, of course, that can be checked very easily in numerical simulations to see how many of these guys present at redshift 10 or 20 have since been annihilated by merging. One often also talks about formation of these dwarf halos at lower redshift. Maybe it forms here at redshift 2. I could imagine that happening, although it seems a little unlikely because as we observe, the gravitational instability has been turned off. And anyway, if it did happen, we observe that it's going to be difficult to get the baryons to settle in there, cool, recombine, and allow stars to form, or at least allow H1 to be present to be detected. So I'm assuming you don't have to make big corrections for loss of dwarfs by merging or for formation of late halos. Observational issues. This is straightforward. We have our Arecibo going forward. You notice that the NSF committee of senior committee, they called it, which is to say suits, got together and decided that they would recommend that the NSF stop funding the Arecibo Observatory. It was, in my mind, an entirely political play. It's easy to recommend shutting off Cerro Ceiba because that's the major scientific facility in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It attracts busloads of students and tourists, people coming there to visit. No one is going to shut that facility down. But that it should be recommended was just amazing, particularly since it is, to my mind, probing now a really interesting scientific problem, along with many others, of course. And then we have to worry about the fact that there may be early type extreme dwarfs in voids. For all we know, an extreme dwarf can form some stars and deposit enough energy in the remaining gas through supernovae as to blow all the gas away, making a self-induced early type galaxy rather than one that was induced by interaction with neighboring galaxies. So there it is. Perhaps you have a number?
We're still working on
it. Oh, okay. Oh. So, I recognize a couple of voices.
Good.
So this 10%, so your voids are like 10 megaparsecs, or?
They're much smaller than that. So I was using a nominal number. People often say 10%. I have no reason to question it, so what the heck? Why doesn't it want to go backward? Maybe I shouldn't have said that quite so strongly. Here is 10 megaparsecs. So it's maybe 10 megaparsecs diameter. It is a small void. But of course, it's uniquely important because we're sitting right on the edge of it.
But then how do you know it's 10% mean?
I don't. I suspect that because this is small, its density is higher than 10%. But it's a number to work with. And of course, the simulations could tell us the probability distribution in void density, given that you have a sheet of galaxies right next to it.
So it's a number density of galaxies? A mass density.
Sorry?
So the density is mass density or number density?
Oh, I start with the matter density.
Okay.
We are told that there is appreciable mass in voids defined by L-star galaxies. A typical number I read is 10%. Second question, of course, what is the density of halos? Of course, of halos massive enough to be able to hold on to their H1, which is to say the number density of halos at circular velocity greater than VC greater than 15. I'm going to divide that by 10, if in fact the density is 10% of the mean. And I'm going to assume that I didn't lose any through merging or gain any through late formation. And of course, if you find there's a discrepancy, it's no emergency. This is one special case. But we can hope that people will be able to extend this test to other nearby voids.
Haven't people tried to maybe do this, say for SDSS? I mean, I think I recall that, but basically, does the luminosity function change with the environment?
I think it must. You showed us examples of the dwarfs around the giant halo losing mass through harassment, through tidal stripping of the outer parts. And so you do lose mass. You do change the mass function for the subhalos of a big halo. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining that over here, that effect doesn't operate. And in fact, we notice it doesn't operate in these spots where these guys are. Because surely, if they'd been harassed, they wouldn't have still have those delicate H1 disks.
Well, that's a very small scale. Like, but I was thinking about larger scale environments, like void or whatever.
Right. That's why I'm stressing a redshift 10 or 20, when it wasn't such a very different place. And I'm assuming that by that time you've made these low mass halos. Am I wrong about that?
Probably not. Actually, I think at a very high redshift in words, there are no many structures.
There are no massive dark matter halos in Borgs.
Yeah.
Yes.
So also, actually, structure formation is very fair to the, at the high redshift.
In small Borgs.
Even in bigger words.
I think I misspoke. Let me go back to this nice simulation. We are not surprised that there is matter in this void. Not all the dark matter is seen because resolution prevents you from seeing the lowest mass of the halos. There are low mass halos. I presume they formed early, along with the low mass halos in these concentrations. I'm assuming that many of the low mass halos in these concentrations have been eaten or are now subhalos of halos. These guys have just sat around, not being shredded. And I'm assuming that since they formed early, you guys can tell me how many there are for unit volume.
So it seems like there'd be a lot. I'm not quite sure what mass that corresponds to, but between
A CBC.
The very smallest things, I'm sort of getting on the order of 100 per cubic megaparsec.
But But are these guys capable of holding on to their H1?
No. So if you go up to, so it would be on the order of a few per cubic megaparsec.
At redshift
0 or
redshift
10? Co-moving.
Yeah.
And so 1/10 per cubic megaparsec. So what's the volume of that void?
James, are you quoting the structures that have V peaks greater than 15 or by redshift 0 or early
redshift? I'm guessing from the masses. So I was just looking at what the mass function is at redshift 20. And then I have to actually go through and figure out what the velocity, what the concentrations for those things are.
So what's the volume here? 5 by 5 by 5?
It's 1/3 of.
Yes, it's 1/3 of.
4 times 7.
4 pi over 3
that's
times 8 cubed. So this is on the order of 1,000.
Where did you get the rank there from?
Times. Well, it's 4 pi over. No, sorry, it's 4 times.
That's about a third of the.
Yes, yeah,
it's a third of all. You've taken a big bite out of the apple.
It's 1,200, so there should be hundreds of them.
But that's the 8 megaparsecs today, of course, right?
That's
8 megaparsecs today, right?
Oh, this is
back
here. This is co-moving. Right?
Yeah.
Sure. But the stuff that was on the edge of streamed out due to peculiar velocity.
Well, that's part of the loss.
Of course, it's part of it. Right?
That's why the density here is 10% of the mean.
Sure.
Because the rest is streamed out.
But you need the 10% of the original volume.
Yes, yes.
Co moving volume.
That's this 10.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, I missed that 10. Thank you.
So the luminosity functions are also different.
Do you mean mass functions?
I was thinking as a function of environment.
The mass functions are clearly different. But remember, that's at the present effort.
Yeah.
Go back to redshift 10.
Yeah.
Are the mass functions here and here so very different? I'm assuming that there are lots of dwarfs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But this part opened up. Mm-hmm. This part grew together. You merged the dwarfs to make subhalos within halos. You didn't here.
What I was thinking was the present day luminosity function, in terms of the number of dwarfs you get, differs also within those filaments, say, from the regions around. I mean,
yes.
As you were saying with the H1.
And you could well imagine that that's a consequence of the growth of structure since redshift 10.
So I think you should have given us a warning before if you wanted these numbers, because we are not, we're not used to the graduate school days. But thank you very much, and any more questions? Andrew?
That's a quick question. There's a recent paper that does this on much larger scales with Sloan. And what they do is they take halos in a simulation and they just rank order them, take luminosities, rank order them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But they find that there is avoidance like this, something like 8 magnitudes.
Yes.
I don't know if you...
The trouble is that I don't want to be misunderstood when I say one has to be cautious of semi-analytic models for galaxy formation. One tends to build in what's observed, which is not a foolish thing to do at all. And I see a considerable amount of that in that Sloan paper. So, I don't know for sure.
Well, that paper, all it did was rank order luminosities and rank order masses. I mean, it just seems like it's saying that there aren't that many small mass things.
Well, but they're there in the theory. They're not there in our local neighborhood. I guess you would have to take the position that one of us is wrong, that I have a bad sample, or else that they have a bad analysis.
Well, it's also different scales. It's very different.
Of course, of course. And they sample a lot more luminous galaxies than the ones I worried about.
Another way of putting this, and maybe this is in the Sloan paper, is what's the most massive thing that doesn't find stars?
Why don't you plug in?
Because I presume this says that there are 10 to the 10 solar mass halos with no stars in them, or there's not enough to detect.